Paul Mayer's Children's Television Archive.
Well, can we? I didn't bring any notes because I used to bring a whole lot of notes with me, you know, because I had a lot of research done. But I found almost my naive questions is almost what a reader would want to know.
Yeah, well.
So can I just ask you how'd you get started? Where are you from originally?
Well, actually, I was born in Worthington, Indiana. And that's just a short distance from Indianapolis. And a lot of my family lived in that area. As a matter of fact, pretty near all of my family were in show business. They had repertoire companies and traveled in the Middle West more than any place else. So when I was a child, my first part was being carried on stage as a baby. And there was a spot there where the baby was supposed to cry, and so they would pinch me on the derriere, you know, on cue, and I would cry, and that was my first speaking part on the stage. And so my folks thought that the profession was very tough, and they didn't want me to go on show business after a while. Mm-hmm. You know? So my father was quite good at drawing and art and also building scenery and things like that. I guess it kind of rubbed off on me. And so I picked up drawing a bit. So they figured, well, maybe I should go into some art profession of some kind. Well, when we moved to New York, my mother was in vaudeville at the time, and her agent had charge of doing some pictures for Paramount. I think it was the souvenirs, you know, the old souvenir pictures where they took old pictures and then made comical comments during the scenes that they showed. So he knew someone at Fleischer's. So he got in touch with them and suggested that I go over there with my poor samples and see if I could get a job, and which I did. And the funny part about it to me was that the first week that I was there, they had to let a lot of people go because of the economic reasons. So I was out. I only worked there a week and I was out. Well, in the meantime, I didn't know what to do. My cousin happened to be a barber.
How old were you at this point?
Well, I was around 18 or 18? 17 or something like that. When I started in this place, I was very young. Consider that young.
What were you like, you know, in high school? How would you describe yourself?
Well,
as a teenager, were you?
I think I was a little more adult.
Girl's man, or
no. I think I was a little sophisticated at that time because I was in show business most of the time beforehand.
You're a little ahead of the rest of your
class.
I
would say that I sometimes would pull gags, you know, in the class, and the teacher, you know, would write a note and send it home and says, "Your boy acts silly in school," one of those things, you know. So I didn't quite fit in, I don't believe. You know, I was always sort of aloof or something, you know. And lots of times I would draw in my notebooks rather than write out the...
Oh, really?
Write out the themes.
You doodle.
I would doodle or illustrate, actually. And one day, one of the teachers, I think it was in a history class, it was something to do with the Egyptians or something like that. So as he was lecturing on this particular subject, he came down the aisle and he saw me, you know, drawing in the book, you know. He says, "Now there's an example of a poor student. He's not paying attention, and this is a terrible thing for him to be doing while I'm trying to teach him something." Yeah. But he came along and saw the book. He said, "Oh, well, this is not bad." And he says, "Now here's a good example of the interest that you children should take in your lessons." So he showed it up and said that I had really paid attention and I was illustrating all the things that he'd been talking about. So I was a big hit there one day. But I think that I was a sort of a poor subject as far as being a student was concerned, because as I said, it seemed to me like I was familiar with a lot of things already, you know. With they talking about George Washington or something, I'd say something about, you know, he threw the dollar across the Potomac, and in those days the dollar went further, you know. So the teacher would, you know, that's enough of that, and be the end. I'd be sent home with a note.
Yeah. What were your parents like at that time? They were show business parents. Were they kind of encouraging you to get into the business, or?
Well, not really. No, I mean, there wasn't any.
Were you one of those?
She wasn't. None of them were stage mothers, as they call them. You know, like pushy or trying to get me into. It was just a sort of a natural thing.
Because,
if I did anything.
Yeah, because you were in show business, did you travel around a lot, or?
Yes, this was a repertoire company that traveled.
And was that right through high school you did that?
No. We finally, when I wound up in high school, of course, they settled down.
Uh-huh.
And my grandmother...
Are you an only child?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
My grandmother opened up a rooming house in New York, and that's where we settled down, and where I went to high school. And as I said, I don't know, I didn't know what to do, was since they didn't encourage me to go into show business. But I did attempt to go into a vaudeville act one time. I was a bellboy in a skit.
Mm-hmm.
You remember the skits they had with the scenery and mm-hmm. everything? And so I was to do a dance and a comedy part. But at that time, the scenery moving was prohibitive because of the economics and the unions
mm-hmm.
charged so much to move the scenery and everything like that, and even charged you to put it up when you go to each theater, that they just abandoned the whole thing at that point. So that was the end of my show business career, you might say. And then I got a job at the National Bellas Hess, who illustrated, the studio illustrated for National Bellas Hess, that a mail order house in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And I was I laid out pages, and I was a gopher. And, what's happening here?
Oh, I thought I'd move it. You're talking in this direction. I thought I'd move it in this direction.
Oh, well, I'm sorry.
That's all right.
Was trying not to pay any attention to it, because when I see a microphone, I have to start, you know, pouring it on, like, you know, or I feel like I do. Or I'm conscious of somebody listening,
they're kind
lousy.
Of obstructive, aren't
Should
they?
Should have something on here that I couldn't see, and I do a lot of fouling up sometimes, or searching for proper words and things, which I hope that you will forgive me. It isn't necessary as long as you're going to edit it, so.
Oh, sure, I'll send it back to you. And
say anything I want to, right?
Sure.
That is, acceptable, I should say.
Yeah, this is just a deck, and that's what I do when I get home, is I edit it down. So I listen to it over and over again. I listen to it in my car. I listen to it everywhere.
Do you sleep? You
Well, sure. So I learn to almost know what you're going to say next before you say it. That's how well I know it.
Well, there's no need of me saying anything. Why don't you just record it yourself? Save me a lot of breath.
Go ahead.
Well, now I think we came to
we came to the point where you were in high school and you were just graduating, and now how soon was it that you went to the Fleischer place after that?
Oh, that was several years, I guess. And I worked at this National Bellas Hess place for a short time, and of course the same thing happened there. They had to let people go, and I was out the door again. And I said, when I worked at Fleischer's, I worked there a week, and they let people go, and I was one of the ones, naturally, just having been hired.
Mm-hmm.
So my cousin worked on the American Export Line ships, and he got me a job on the boats in the meantime, because I didn't know what, you know, I was stymied, I didn't know what else to do. So after a short period, I went to the Mediterranean on several trips, and when I got back, there was a phone call saying, well, we're taking on some more people. Would you like to come back?
Popeye actually has done some sailing then, huh?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And I never got seasick.
That's interesting.
I could say. But I don't know what to say about that, except that I had no passport on the boat. First off, I was on the crew's mess. That's why I started out. And I worked up to the bellboy. There was only one bellboy in these boats. It was a very luxurious type of ship. It was a combination freighter and passenger ship, but very modern.
Mm-hmm.
And they had the bells, you know, the chimes, and I used to invent little melodies to wake people up in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
Different melodies, da 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 da, la da 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 da, you know that. And they all looked forward to the various melodies that I could get out of this, the chimes. And I would entertain at the captain's parties, you know, play the piano, and do a buck and wing in the ballroom, you know. And I was quite a versatile person, you might say. And they wanted me to study for being a purser, but I had no idea of remaining in that line of work.
A what now?
A purser on a ship. Well, that's the a purser is the fellow that takes care of the passengers in various ways and makes sure that they have the proper staterooms and whatnot. And they have to speak.
Kind of like a host.
Like a host, yeah. More or less. No, he's an intermediate between the captain if there's any trouble and the rest of the crew. Mm-hmm. And, of course, they had to speak a foreign language, actually, because it went to the Mediterranean, mm-hmm. So they had to be able to speak some foreign language. But, of course, my French was very poor, it would have taken me quite a while to get up in French enough to get a job like that. So I'm being very young, you know, that was out of the question. So I don't know whether they just said that as, to keep me on there. So figuring I'd follow the life of the sea. They didn't know what I actually did, like show business and all that sort of thing. So let's see, what else can I say about it?
So
I got back...
Yeah, they called you back again.
Then I went into... I continued on in that same position I'd left in Opaking.
Now, did you receive a letter at home?
No, it was a phone call.
Phone call?
Yeah.
And who was on the phone? Just the secretary or
something? Well, I don't remember exactly. It probably is.
Uh-huh.
Some secretary, I suppose. I don't remember that.
And
really.
They wanted to call you back as an artist? Is that what you were doing?
Well, it's the same as an opaque, the same job that mm-hmm. I had left. So I hadn't failed in the job.
Mm-hmm.
And then I became an inker and an in-betweener. I advanced through the...
But what were you drawing at the time? Were they Betty Boops or...?
Yes, Betty Boops. And there were several other cartoons. And I think they were doing screen songs and things like that. The Popeye, I think they maybe had just been talking about it at the time. So that was a new character that mm-hmm. was being introduced. So I think I started about 1932, and then by 1934, that's when I started to do the Popeye.
How did you first start hearing about the Popeye?
Well,
was it kind of a... Did you actually ink a Popeye before you had any association with doing it?
Yes.
As a prototype, kind of?
Right. Well, they transfer the drawings on cells
mm-hmm.
by inking. You trace the drawing on the cells. That's one of the processes that takes place mm-hmm. during the making of producing the picture.
So one day you came in and... they handed you this to do, right? And it was kind of a Popeye figure, and that's
well, no, I wouldn't. It was a scene. These are scenes in the picture, and they hand out the scenes for people to work on. You get so many drawings in a scene to ink,
mm-hmm.
And it wasn't just one drawing, as it seems like you think it was, you know. It was a whole scene.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone would receive a certain amount of this to finish. So, as I said, in other instances, in other pictures, I would, if there were certain characters that I thought were funny or at the time I was working on, I would supply some kind of a voice for it just for fun, you know, sitting at the desk drawing and inking and whatnot.
Just to kind of and, help your imagination go along.
Well, go along and also to fun. Relieve the monotony of constantly doing these cells, which, you know, one after another with just slight changes in them. And it was quite a long, drawn-out job, you see. And also the other workers seemed to get a kick out of it, you know. They would encourage me a little bit to do it, you know. So I continued just doing that. Every once in a while, it wasn't a continuous thing, you know. So when the Popeye came along, then I did
What were some of the effects that you could do? Were they like sound effects of objects, things happening?
Yeah, well, chickens, or animals, and characters in the pictures.
Were any of these voices that you were doing used later on in the cartoons?
No. But I was asked after they heard me do the Popeye thing. Actually, I mean, I suppose they heard me doing the others, but didn't pay any attention to it.
So you got this Popeye drawing, and you thought, well, what would this guy sound like? And you?
No, I heard that this time they were doing the cartoons. Uh-huh. I heard the voice.
Yeah, and they had a different.
I had to.
They had two other voice men, didn't they?
Not that I know of. There was only one that did the Popeye.
One other one.
Yeah, that was Costello.
Uh-huh.
And maybe you're thinking of Bluto. I don't know. They had, I don't know how many Blutos various times. Gus Wickiat was the first one that I worked with.
Well, I have a book called A Complete History of Television, Volume 1 and Volume 2.
Oh.
And it has in there, on Popeye, it has two other names. I should have written them down and brought them.
Well,
I thought you would know them. But two other names, and then your name was written down as Jack Mercer.
Oh, you don't know who the other names were?
I'll get them to you. You know, when
well, that's news to me.
I'll write them down when I send this along.
Nobody's ever said anything about them doing anyone else doing it.
So there was this Costello,
as far as I knew,
man doing it. And how long did he do it while you were working on the Popeyes?
Well, I guess about a year or
about
so. But they didn't do too many cartoons as far as I could see.
So you kind of imitated.
Well, I copied his tonal qualities, but I changed it a little bit, you know. I put a little bit of myself in it.
A little more personality.
More personality, uh-huh. And he was a sort of a gruff character. I suppose you remember. You know, it was, hello! You know, one of those kind.
Yeah.
And I did it lighter and more friendly. And it led finally to being able to expand his association with other characters better, you know, like an Uncle Popeye for the nephews and whatnot. He wasn't so gruff against olive oil and whatnot. So I felt like the first time, I mean, he was like an old, hard, flea-bitten character, you know.
And so you were imitating this Popeye, and you say someone kind of came in and overheard this?
Yes.
And said, hey, that's pretty good.
Well, at first, I didn't think it was too good. I mean, I had a good ear, and it was, you know, I didn't intend to ever do it. I had no intention of or ever thinking I would ever do it. But it was a sort of a rough characterization, you might say. So when they approached me and said, would you like to try out for it? Then I said, oh, well, geez, you know, this is something different. Maybe I better, you know, try it out, see if I can improve it in any way, and actually get the quality that I felt was necessary for the real good tone. So I went home and practiced about a week or so. And I finally, one night, this tone broke in my throat, you know. I grabbed my throat and I said, oh my God, you know, I didn't realize it felt like my head was coming off, you know. So, it was a horrible vibration all the time with this thing. So
did it give you a headache at first?
No, it didn't give me a headache. It gave me kind of a sore throat. Uh-huh. It was, you know, irritating when I first started. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't, you know, used to it. And so I said to myself, well, now I think I have it well enough that I would try out for it, which I did. And I gave an audition over a telephone to somebody in Paramount. And I, you know, I think that the telephone seems to cut down on any quality, at least in those sure. days. It shouldn't be a good as
and
good
did they, as did they call you
no
for the interview, or did you call them?
No, someone in the studio was either Lou or Dave or someone, one of the executives, if you want to call that, had called them and said, look, we got a guy here that's going to give you an audition. So they, whoever was on, I think no one was Lou Diamond, I wouldn't say for sure who it was, in Paramount, but there was no affirmative remark from that end.
Can you,
so I didn't know what,
kind of describe to me, I mean, did he say, hello, yeah, go, you're going to do an audition, go ahead, is that what he said, kind of?
Oh my God, I don't, that's, how many, 44 years ago, I don't remember.
Uh-huh.
So it might have been that they just handed me the phone and they said, do the Popeye, you know, and then they handed the phone back, as far as I can remember.
Uh-huh. And you just did a few lines. A
few lines,
laugh,
something like I am what I am, or whatever the hell it was. I don't even remember that. Maybe I sang the song, I'm not sure. Isn't it funny? I don't see why, you know, everybody asks you these detailed things, and who can remember that stuff? Not knowing whether I was even going to do it or not.
Yeah,
at
right.
the time, I didn't think it was that
right.
important. Who would, you know? I suppose there's some people that, you know, everything they do, they write down in a diary or something. I don't know. I just let things go as they would come, and that was it. Even today, there's so many things people ask me, and I can't remember
right.
things. Like, there was Gordon Sheen told us, Mike Berryer, that when he first came to the studio, I helped him opaque, showed him how to do it and all that sort of thing, you know. And I don't even remember that.
Hmm.
So it just went along like a natural thing, that's all. No importance to it. And I think that all along it was just about like that. Nobody ever said anything to me about, you know, doing a great job or anything. You know, they just accepted it. I was doing it, that's
right,
all.
Right.
And as I said today, now when people say, geez, that's terrific, that's great, and all that stuff, it's hard for me to accept it because, as I said, I don't know whether they're putting me on or what.
Oh, they're never putting you on.
Well, that's the attitude I have.
Yeah.
And since nobody ever, it was only the last part of the Kinney productions mm-hmm. for TV that they finally started to say, you know, in other words, I figured they were using me as a means of popularizing the fact that they had done the Popeyes in the past for King Features mm-hmm. or anyone else that came in, you know. Then they would say, here's our Popeye, you know, he's the expert and he knows Popeyes and all this, and he writes the stories, and I illustrated the first story that for King Features, that for their TV series, you know, Mike Meyer and I wrote the story, and then I introduced it to the people that are watching, you know.
I want to jump to that in a minute, yeah. I want to hold that off for a minute. We're still back here in Florida. That's where.
No, I wasn't in Florida yet. Now you're jumping. This was all in New York.
Oh, in New York, and then later
sure.
moved to Florida.
Later moved to Florida.
I see.
But that time I was into the.
I see.
Thing. So well, they moved down there, I think, because of the strike.
Oh really?
And they got certain allowances for the taxes and whatnot. You know, if they moved and built a studio down there, they thought that was a big item at the time. They were trying to induce other movie studios to move down there to begin with. So mm-hmm. they figured that, you know, this would be one
So they built this huge complex.
A huge studio, modern, air conditioning, plenty of air conditioning. And
did you get your own office in that building?
Well, I had a room which I worked with another story writer. It wasn't just it was an extra room for me alone.
Mm-hmm.
They had little, you might say, cells, tummy holes, around a plaza type building they built, you know. And several people were put in these little rooms.
So how'd you finally hear you got the job as the voice of Popeye?
Well, one day they asked me if I'd care to go over and do some voices. And these were incidental voices in other cartoons. And then after a couple of weeks or so of that, then they said, well, we're going to try you out for the Popeye voice. So it was just like that.
But you said you kind of did it over the phone at first.
Yes.
And then they knew you could do it, but then they said, okay, now we're going to try it on film?
No.
Is that how they kind of...
It wasn't that way at all. They didn't say anything about trying it on film or anything else. It was just, as far as I was concerned, I gave the audition and that was it. So later on, as I said, then they asked me if I would care to, since I had been doing some of these other, you know, chicken boy and mm-hmm. sound effects and crap.
And weren't they having problems with this the other Popeye? He wanted more money, or he was kind
of
temperamental, or?
That was the scuttlebutt. And actually, I never pursued it any further than what someone else would say. I, mm-hmm. you know, I wasn't interested in how it came about.
Mm-hmm.
And I've never wanted to accuse him of doing anything, out of the way, because I really couldn't prove it in
yeah.
any way, you know. So I had to take other people's words for it. Now, some people said that he got persnickety and wanted more money.
Mm-hmm.
And some said that he demanded to take a vacation and go to Europe, you know, and this, of course the production continued on.
Mm-hmm.
And whether this was true or not, I haven't any idea
mm-hmm.
why they wanted to change it. All they did want to change it, that's all I know. And it was surprising to me, you know, it was such a... The whole thing was just like a fantasy to me, you know.
So how did they first tell you that you were going to be in a recording studio doing Popeye?
Well, I think somebody just said that we're going to do a Popeye and you're going to try out for it.
Uh-huh.
So we went.
And who did you sit down with? Who was?
Well,
it wasn't May yet, was it?
Yeah, she was still doing the olive oil.
She was olive oil at the time. Yeah.
But I think that I was taken over to Paramount, where the theater used to be. And in one of the studios, they had a projection studio there, several as a matter of fact, but there was one where they rehearsed the Popeyes. In other words, the picture was done first in those days.
Mm-hmm.
So they'd run the picture off on the screen, and you would sit there with the script and try to... do the lines along with the animation, you know. And they had bouncing balls going up and down that cued you for your lines. So they'd run the picture over and over and over again, and you would get familiar with the lines and the script. And
then watch the bouncing ball.
Watch the bouncing ball to naturally to cue you in. I mean, every sentence had a bouncing ball that mm-hmm. would carry you through the whole sentence, you know, the timing. Because, as I said, it was already animated, so you had to synchronize your voice with that bouncing ball.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to get used to that, there was a lot of, you know, running the picture over and over again. Then as they ran the picture over and over again, there were a lot of spots that seemed to be empty, and, you know, so that's where the ad-libbing came in. You would think of funny remarks to make in between your regular written lines. And sometimes there'd be several thoughts come to mind. You might, in a recording, you might use one or two, and maybe the next time they record the picture, you would change it off and use something else, or something might just come off the top of your head, mm-hmm. you know, in the anxiety, not the excitement of yeah. doing the picture, you mm-hmm. know, had the music behind you, sound effects, the whole thing was, you know, then it was like being in a show, more or less. You know?
Yeah, I saw a picture where it looked like people were, I didn't know if that was for a picture or if it was really the way it was.
No, that was the studio shot. Yeah. And everybody was crammed in this small soundstage.
Uh-huh. Was that really the way they did it?
Yes.
So you were right up against the violinist and the...
Well, they were in back, of course. Uh-huh. And the sound effects men were in back of them. So it was a cacophony of sounds. And sometimes you had to cup your ear to try to hear what you were saying.
Uh-huh.
And we stood up closer to the screen, of course. You know? It was a small screen, naturally, but... But there were everybody that crowded in this room was there, you know.
Was it hot in there, or you say it was air conditioned?
Well, that you're confusing. This was in New York.
Oh, I see.
In Florida, they had a huge sound stage. It's supposed to be very scientifically designed, and the greatest sound that was ever perceived.
I see.
I don't know, but they had buffles or whatever.
How many years went on in New York? That'll help me.
Mm. Well, I was there about 32. You know, these kind of things now, I'm stumped exactly how long that was.
Yeah.
It was in the 40s anyway. Uh-huh. But exactly when, I don't remember.
So it was about 10 years in New York.
I suppose
something like
so, something on that order. Yeah. See, those statistics I haven't at all. Mm-hmm.
And so there was a whole team of writers writing things, but you were kind of ad-libbing at times. Were there?
Well, others would ad-lib too. You know, if we'd hear each other's ad-libs, and then they'd comment or think of something to answer,
mm-hmm.
and it worked both ways all the way around.
You mentioned you were kind of serious in school. Were you serious in the studio, or were there a lot of goofing around at times?
Well, some, you know, naturally, being creative, you goof around sometimes, but not too much, because the job was to be done. You can't waste a lot of time, you know, mm-hmm. fooling around. Mm-hmm.
Let's say you recorded a whole cartoon, and do they play it back right away and watch it, and then let's try it again sometimes?
Well, naturally, there would, if they didn't catch anything during the recording, they would play it through and then see if it was okay.
Mm-hmm.
And naturally, they might find, you know, catch something that they didn't like, they'd have to do it over again.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, that didn't happen too often, because we were well rehearsed. Even the musicians might hit a clinker, you know, or the sound effect man might mm-hmm. drop.
Maybe a month?
Well, about, you mean the whole process?
Yes, I have one question.
I think they claim 16 weeks. From beginning to end.
What do you mean, Hanna-Barbera, or who? You...
Yeah, well, all of them did about the same amount of time,
mm-hmm.
as far as I know.
So, like, how
you
much?
You know, from the beginning of the story,
uh-huh.
To the animation, to the sound, and the whole bit. You know, it's,
well, I mean, what I'm trying to get at is, were you working just year round?
Oh yeah.
There, I mean,
we did more
how much
than...
rehearsal time did it take to do one cartoon?
Well, we might spend a day on it or so.
And then it would take maybe 2 days in the studio, maybe?
Well, actually, we'd have one recording date. It would be done in a morning session, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
Or if it was a tough one, it might take a little longer, but that's usually the usual time. See, the music would be rehearsed separately.
Mm-hmm.
And then most everyone was familiar with the picture, so it was a matter of running the picture off several times. And that didn't take much time mm-hmm. to do.
Tell
and
me,
compared to everything else.
When did you meet your wife, or what were you doing socially at that time?
Well, my wife was, there was animator Tom Moore, And he and I used to hang around together. As a matter of fact, we did some acts together during the Paramount parties that they'd have, and they'd have a regular show. So he and I used to team up and do a lot of screwy acts together. And he was the brother-in-law of my wife. So that's how we met.
Mm-hmm. Your current wife?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And what year was that that you started?
It was about 25 years ago.
Oh, really?
Long haul, right? Uh-huh.
And you never had any children along the way? Never wanted to? Because of your career, perhaps?
Well, whatever.
Many reasons.
Yeah.
So you mentioned your Popeye was a little more friendlier than the older Popeye.
Well, I felt it was.
A little lighter,
uh-huh. More comedic. Mm-hmm. I tried to make him a little lighter character, you know. Rambunctious type of guy.
Were there any particular lines or sayings or characteristics that you invented?
Well, I can't say right off. There was a lot of ad-lib lines that I invented as I went along, but I don't keep them in mind.
Uh-huh. You forget which you thought up and which was on the script.
That's right, yeah. Because there were other story men, of course, that wrote things. But a lot of the words I screwed up quite a bit, you know, like imagination.
Yeah.
Put a lot of that type of thing, you know. Uh-huh. This is a bear skin, and I think I
give me some more of those. Give me some more of those.
I'm flabbergasted. Yeah. Well, that's hard now for me to remember all that stuff.
Well, you're still doing it. You've done it all these years.
Yes, but I mean, I don't keep them in mind because somehow or other, when you get stereotyped that way, then you can't create anything different. I mean, uh-huh. Those always stick in your mind, you know. So whenever the occasion arises, I make up a word or something like that fits the situation.
Mm-hmm.
And
to keep it moving. Yeah.
To keep it moving, more or less, you know. And not being repetitive.
Well, Blow Me Down was another one.
Well, those were, I'm afraid, were in the strip, you know. They were mm-hmm. used in the strip, the mm-hmm. Seagar's Popeye strip. So there were a few things that were taken from that. It's funny, we very seldom referred to the strip for our stories or anything. Mm. They all had to be created for animation, as mm-hmm. it were, you know. Because he had long, drawn-out stories, and they, you know, took a long time to come to any finality to them. So we have to have a beginning, a middle, and an end, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And something that would create competition between Bluto and Popeye, which I don't believe he had too much in his strip. It was just a sort of a go-along story type of thing.
The old Popeye voice, whatever happened to him?
He's deceased
mm-hmm.
at the present time, if you want to put it that way.
When did that happen?
Oh, a couple of years ago, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And you hadn't seen him all those years? I mean,
no. I met him once, uh-huh. of course.
Years later?
I never saw him since then. He went to the coast, I believe, or something like that. Somebody said he opened up a bar and grill or something like that, and was taking credit for doing the voice all those years. Mm. As a matter of fact, his obituary stated that he had done the Popeye voice for 25 years, and he did all recording out in the coast. This is the first time I've ever been to the coast.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't want to quote that. That's off the record.
Okay.
Because I think that
sure.
would be a little disrespectful.
Sure.
I don't want to take any credit away from him, you know. But actually, there was another guy that did this in vaudeville. His name was Welch. I suppose you've heard of that, right? And he dressed up like Popeye, and had a rather gruff imitation of Popeye, but he did olive oil and Bluto and sweet pea. He claimed he did everything, and also for the cartoons.
Mm-hmm.
and he did it for 25 years or more.
He's passed away. Yeah, I have a record that is a different Popeye singing, and it's really deep and rough. And
as I say, that could be Costello. Was it a Popeye record? I don't think Costello made a Popeye record.
It was pretty recent. It looked like a recent record.
Well, and that was
him.
Yeah. Welch, I mean. There's some Popeye stories, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Popeye goes to the zoo, or Popeye goes to...
That was mine.
Oh, that was yours.
Yeah.
But I have that one, and I have one Popeye goes to outer
space. Well,
my
name is on it.
Yeah, it's on the record itself.
Yeah.
It's not on the jacket. Yeah, I have about 3 or 4 Popeye records.
Yeah. Well, as I said, he also passed away, and his obituary was in Variety, so my wife got mad and she called him up. And they ran another article in afterwards saying that Popeye lives and stated my name, and said several other people had written in about it, knowing me.
Mm-hmm.
Some guys from England were writing a book also at the time. Webb, I don't know whether you've heard of him or not. Anyway, I had corresponded with him for about a year, back and forth with all this information and stuff. So they saw the article in Variety that Welch had done the voice. So they wrote to Variety and said that that was false. So my wife wasn't the only one that complained about it.
Yeah, I heard Tom Hatton mention that there were people doing supermarket appearances.
That
was probably one of those people, yeah.
No, it wasn't. This Welch wasn't the one that did that particular thing. I think he was talking about others.
Mm-hmm.
But as I said, he had appeared in vaudeville, and Sammy Timberg was his agent, and he was our musical director at the time, you see. They didn't want me to go on the road because they figured, from the other experience from the other fellow, that maybe I would take off also,
mm-hmm.
And it would be difficult for them to call me when they wanted me for recordings. So he had a rather grotesque mask, and to me it was horrible looking, but he got away with it,
That's funny. I was asking you how did you develop some of the ad libs? We were going over some of the other ones, how you mispronounced words.
Yeah.
And
how would
you were to describe Popeye, let's say, to somebody who didn't know who Popeye was, how would you describe him?
Well, I'd say that naturally he was a salty character and a very moral person, I feel, a universal hero type,
mm-hmm.
and American. And when he gets pushed around too much, why, then he asserts himself, and he makes use of the Spanish to do so. And he doesn't like dishonest. He's an honest person, and he wants to make sure that right is right. Now, I don't know how else to... He's a horrible looking guy to begin with, so he has to have some virtues. I've had people say to me, well, you don't look like him, and I don't know whether to say, well, thank God, or no, So I make a face, well, I try, force myself.
That's pretty good.
Without the pipe? Then I do look like him. I'm sorry. Of course, I had to cover up the arms, though, because that's a dead giveaway. But little kids, when they ask me to do the voice for the kids, they just stand with their mouth open. They can't connect me with Popeye because at the time I don't look too much like him,
It's kind of a mind blower to those kids.
Yeah, it's low, huh?
Yeah. Well,
I feel like, I put these kids in a trauma. They'll have to take them to the hospital.
Well, if you think about it, they've probably been
sitting in front of that tube watching Popeye for endless hours, and
then now they don't expect this voice to come out of a person away from the tube.
How do you have a speaker in his mouth? How does he do that?
Maybe I should carry a tube along with me, you know, so it wouldn't be such a shock.
Yeah.
You know, just stick my head in one a television set, let him have it.
Do you remember at all how many records were recorded through the years? Was there a Popeye fan club?
There probably was, but I think there was one down in Florida someplace that called me up once. I'm not aware of any others, really.
A lot of voice people do personal appearances. Were you one to do that? Or
well, I have done personal appearances. I was on To Tell the Truth as a guest. And several others.
Did they guess?
Well, the funny part about it was, and it surprised me, because I feel that I have a sort of a light, high tone, or high-pitched voice. I don't know. What do you think?
Oh, you do.
Do you? What I mean is, do you feel that there's any Popeye tone in my voice?
No, I wouldn't know it.
Well, when I was...
Because you think that there... You would think if you, to talk with you, you'd have a big, growly voice that's all been used. You know what I mean?
No.
You would lose vocal cords.
That would be horrible. You would go through life like that.
You would think.
Yeah, well, when I was invited on the show, they had a dummy panel, you know, to rehearse with.
Mm-hmm.
So all these people sat in the panelist seats, and of course the contestants then sat in the questioning box, if you want to call it that, or the table where they... So Gary Moore was the host, of course, so he started to ask me questions, and the panelists were supposed to you know, to get a feel of the what the result might be.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the panelists says, geez, he sounds like Popeye. He's got a tone. There's something there in the voice that sounds like Popeye. Well, right away I said, oh, geez, that's hard for me to believe, you know. So Gary Moore says, hey, could you change your voice a little bit? You know, we're a little frightened about this. And I said, well, geez, I'll try. So I spoke in a different tone of voice, you know. So they said, well, all right, we'll try it. So then when the show started, I said, I'm Jack Mercer, you know. And I went through the whole thing with that a different tone. And the other two guys were way up here, you know. They were businessmen, you know. So Kilgallen, or who the... No, that wasn't it. I forgot who the... other woman was on Case.
Peggy Cass.
And who was the other one who was on there?
Dorothy Kilgallen and
Dorothy Kilgallen. It's funny, I guess it was... She was Moss's wife. No, it wasn't Dorothy Kilgallen, I don't believe. She was passed away at that time. Well, it was somebody else. That's one of those persons. And Jean Raymond was, and of course Bill Cullen, they were all panels. But this other lady, whoever she was, now wait a minute, I'm getting ahead of my story. Can you cut that off so I can think? So, anyway, the Jean Raymond, Rayburn, and somebody else, I forgot who it was, they didn't vote for me as being Popeye, but the others did. And Peggy Cass was the one that said, there's something about the timbre, she says, the timbre in his voice that gives me the feeling that he could be Popeye, you know. So that was the only comment made on it. And I don't know, she mispronounced that word, I think, don't you?
Timbre?
Yeah. Well, anyway, there was something quality in the voice. Mm-hmm. So at the finish, when they finally, you know, I stood up and I took the bows and all that stuff, Moore said, you know, you did a fine job, gentlemen. At first we were a little worried that somebody might recognize the tonal quality of Jack's voice and, you know, be a giveaway. Now, I never had that experience in my life. Do you think there was something funny about that? Or I can't figure it out yet, you know. But I'll tell you one thing that was very funny to me. They started off the show, that segment, with a cartoon. You know, a short segment of one of the cartoons. And it broke down, right? You know, it just started off. So Gary Moore came right over to the panels and he confronted me directly. And he says, I'm sorry that, you know, this happened, you know, but we're going to have to, you know, run the thing over. I hope you don't mind. And he, you know, he was directly pointed to me, and the audience must have heard it, you know, because, I mean, they were all listening like this, and it wasn't a sotto voice on his part. But he came right over to me and said, and I said, oh, geez, you know, the whole thing's shot now,
yeah,
for sure, you know. Who the hell would, you know, if he just addressed the panel there and not come over to me. So I figured, well, you know, there it is.
So they all guessed, right?
No, they didn't. They didn't select me. So now there's another thing to that. If they don't select anyone, you know, you split up a lot of dough.
Right, $500
or something. So I have a feeling that they work it out between themselves. Every once in a while, they'll let somebody get the whole deal. But somebody always, you know, votes for the other guy to break it up so they don't have to spend all that money. That's my conception of it. But don't quote me.
All right.
Because that's giving away their secrets, maybe. I mean, that's just my version of it. Because after all, it's entertainment, and who cares whether, you know, it's on the level or not.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way the $64 question was, I think, you know. As long as people are amused and they can keep it going, they don't care whether somebody's legitimate or not.
Mm-hmm. What are Max and Dave Fleischer like? Did you get to know them at all? Were they too far up in the executive offices?
Well, Dave was, you know, he directed quite a bit. And especially the boy. Is it cold in here or something?
No, I'm fine.
Oh, all right. Max, he was more or less in his office most of the time. I didn't run into him very many times. And he would come out of his shell once in a while and look around or watch a picture, a finished product, you know. But he wasn't too active as far as I was concerned. Dave was more active in that area. And I think Max was more or less like the godfather of the. If there's something wrong, you can go to him and tell him what was wrong.
Well, I'll see to it that everything is all right, you know. Don't worry.
Not that he was that. I'm just saying that. Anyway, Dave was one of those very happy type guys, you know, always pulling gags, and he loved to pull puns and whatnot, practical jokes and things like that. I remember one time he had something look like a little spiral piece of metal or something like that, and he would come up to you and he'd say, look at this, and he'd keep working it through his lapel until it would come out the other end. I don't. And then he'd laugh, you know. And you figure, you know, you're waiting for something to happen. That's not a quotable.
So,
I'm just telling you things. Yeah. I don't know what the good old do.
So I understand that you went to the went in the service during the war, and May Questel actually did some Popeyes during that time. Is that right?
Well, no, I can't say anything about that because I don't know
what she
claims. And, I just, you know, I heard her on a show. I don't know whether you caught that.
Mike Douglas.
Did you hear her imitation of it?
Yeah, I taped it.
Well, how did you like it? Did you think it was possible?
I'll do a silent comment.
Well, she also said, well, it wasn't so good anyway, you know.
Yeah.
I don't, it wasn't that good or something like that. I mean, she's, I don't know, you know, a lot of cooks, but I wouldn't.
Well, one thing she did mention, though, is that
Had to fix it up.
They had to fix it up a little bit, you know.
Yeah, well, they'd have to fix it up an awful lot, as far as I'm concerned.
What was your relationship like with May through the years?
Well, it's always been compatible.
It must be difficult to work with anyone close to each other all day long.
Well, we weren't all day long.
Uh-huh.
It would only be during the recordings. Mm-hmm. I mean, they would only show up during the...
Did you have any kind of relationship out of the studio at all?
No, I never... I didn't think that was good policy.
Uh-huh.
For just that reason.
Ate at each other's homes or anything?
No. She invited me a couple of times, and I, you know, turned it down just for that reason. I didn't like to get too palsy-walsy with anyone because mm-hmm. I don't feel that it's a proper thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
You work with people, and this way you can avoid any clashes, if you know what I mean. The personalities might clash here and there, you know.
Now, after doing Popeye for so many years, when Fleischer's studio finally closed, did you kind of feel like you were out in the cold world again?
Well, sort of. I mean, after being with one company so long, it was kind of, you know, like floundering around. As
did it happen suddenly, or did you feel it coming?
No, I think there was a little warning beforehand. And things were looking bad. They kept saying about this block booking thing was going out the window. In other words, Paramount could... book a feature picture along with a short and a cartoon,
mm-hmm.
and the government stepped in and broke that up as a monopoly, you know, monopolizing the theaters. So I think that put a crimp in the whole business, and they were becoming more expensive to produce as another reason.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it just started to fall apart right at that point.
How had your salary changed through the years?
Not very much.
Do you mind talking about what was your first salary?
It was about $50
a week. Yeah.
Yeah, but I don't care to comment any further.
Yeah, I wouldn't expect you to.
No, Uncle Sam might be listening, and he's getting all I got now. So.
Since you had no family and you didn't take that many vacations because of your work, did you have a good bundle stuck away?
Well, I wouldn't say it's good, but it's passable, let's say.
Uh-huh. Enough to...
I mean, I don't think
be
I
would secure for
starve
a few
to
years,
death, you know, unless the dollar keeps going down and everybody's in the same boat as far as that's concerned.
What was it like doing the last cartoon for Fleischer? Do you remember?
Did you
get kind of choked up? Did you feel like you were doing your last Popeye?
Not necessarily. I don't know whether we realized it during that particular recording that it was the last one. But those kind of things, I mean, I'm not that sentimental about, you know, blubbering or some woman might do it or something like that, but I mean, when you finish the job, that's it. You know, can't cry over spilt milk,
mm-hmm.
as far as I'm concerned.
So what went through your head at that time?
I would wonder what I was going to do from there on. So I know that a lot of these studios have their cliques of people and their styles.
Mm-hmm.
of writing and whatnot like that, then I felt like it would be very difficult to try to get a job someplace else. Excuse me, which it was rather difficult, you know, to please someone else.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote some stories for Hal Seeger, who was doing some Cocos, as a matter of fact, you know, a whole series of Cocos for Max Fleischer, he in conjunction with Max Fleischer, which seems very peculiar, doesn't it?
Coco the Clown. Yeah.
Coco the Clown. But I mean, going from that and then writing these Cocos. Then there was an end to that, and then I wrote a couple of Deputy Dog stories.
Oh, really?
And then there you know, everything started to fall apart at that point. And then from then on, I just did some commercials every once in a while whenever they'd come up.
Just a few deputy dogs, or what?
Just a few.
You mean like five of them or something?
Well, maybe three or two or something. I don't know. I don't remember exactly.
That's interesting to hear that.
Yeah? Why?
Because I like Deputy Dog, and I'll be talking about it in my book.
Oh.
Just an interesting point.
Lars, I think, maybe he started that series. I don't know. Being a country boy. And he went down to Florida to write some of the stuff. Mm-hmm. And as I said, then that was the end of that bit. And as I did some commercials and whatnot, are we running out of tape?
Sure. No, I think we're doing all right. We're fine right now.
I have plenty more then.
Which
money is it? I know later on you're going to play poker with me and take it all back, right? Well, as I said, I did some voiceovers for Roger Hiss Productions. Are you familiar with those? He puts on these road shows with Bugs Bunny and all, you know, dressed up.
Oh, is he the one who does
characters?
The Bugs Bunny Follies?
Yeah, Follies. They're making a mint out of that thing. So he has done some Popeye shows when they're playing fairs and whatnot. Mm-hmm. So I did some voices for him. And Popeye, I should say. And a few other incidental things along with it. And some commercials I did for the Red Barns. They had these Coca-Cola glasses that they gave away if you bought Coca-Cola, and with the Popeye characters on them. You've heard of those type of things. Mm-hmm. I guess McDonald's doing something like that with their characters, right? And I did for Berlinger's Mills.
Burlington?
Burlington,
yeah.
I'm sorry, Burlington. They put out some Popeye sheets with the Popeye characters on it to keep the kids awake.
Mm-hmm. Well, they've turned out a lot of Popeye products. I mean, so many of them.
Yeah.
I collect... Oh, this is...
For a long time, they didn't have any merchandising at all for the Popeyes. And King Features, I think, objected to it or something. I don't know why. And all of a sudden, when the TV bit... came along, you know, geez, everything came out.
Mm-hmm. Well, they had a Popeye on an airplane, and I saw it. Do you remember that?
No.
Well, there's a really...
I haven't seen a lot of these.
There's an old Popeye's in an airplane. He's waving. I think he's waving. And it was going for $275 at this...
Oh, boy.
And that was, I think, cheap, considering... Mm-hmm. How some of that stuff goes.
There couldn't be too many of those around, that's for sure.
Well, Popeye stuff is all...
No, I meant the airplane one.
Oh, yeah, there's not too many.
Probably rare.
All the stuff you see at Popeye's goes for top dollar.
There was a TV show on that had memorabilia. Mm-hmm. Somebody had collected a lot of these things, and there were quite a few Popeye objects in that.
Mm-hmm.
Something, I think it was one where he's hitting an anvil or something. I can't remember. The sparks are like ding dong, ding dong, ding dong. One of those things.
Yeah.
And some penny banks and I don't know.
Yeah.
Once he was riding something, I don't know what. He was riding something. And I guess you've seen those, haven't you?
Do you collect any of that stuff? Have you ever saved any?
Just a few things. If I happen to see one someplace, well, I might pick it up. I got some a Popeye doll and a Popeye head made out of foam rubber, just a few things. And some greeting cards, you know, based on the Popeye character and Sweet Pea and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And I have some posters that I got from
some of the
Red Barn. The displays, you know, in the stores, displaying the glasses and whatnot. That's all, just a few things.
Did you say you're not so sentimental? A sentimental person would kind of grab onto all that stuff.
Well, yeah. I don't know. I know I did it, so I mean, I don't have to be reminded. But
anyone walking by in a shopping center looking at you wouldn't know you were Popeye, and you kind of have that. You have a touch of grasping onto the famous, and you can still be private in your own way.
Well, that's me, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, in other words, I enjoy my privacy. I don't.
You don't mention it.
I
much
don't
to
mention
people.
It. As a matter of fact, I don't tell anybody what I do because I don't like to be bothered with Claude and people running over and asking for autographs and all that stuff, you know.
Has anyone and just heard your name and said, Jack Mercer, are you the Jack Mercer? And is there much of that going on?
Only if they mention Popeye. Say, if I'm Popeye, you're Popeye? But the name doesn't seem to mean anything.
Yeah.
I only got screen credit for stories.
Mm-hmm.
And for some reason or other, they never liked to give voice people screen credit.
Mm-hmm.
Paramount.
It wasn't
I think they didn't
really
like
until
the,
King Features came out that you started seeing your name appear. Isn't that right?
Only for the stories.
Uh-huh.
Hmm. There was never any credit for voices, even in King Features. Hanna-Barbera said that they give screen credit for voices, but it might be at the end of the picture, and it goes like this, you know.
Yes.
I mean, geez, you know,
yes.
You've got to look fast, or they
right.
have titles and things appearing over it, or some kind of action or something that covers it up a bit.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just for record, I suppose. If somebody was interested enough in it, they could stop the film and maybe spot it someplace.
Yes, yes.
You know, or they could say, well, we gave him screen credit. I don't know what the deal is on that. So anyhow, I'm getting a little exposure now from these interviews and whatnot, and UPI interviews for the papers and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
But there's been so many, maybe that's why so many people, I believe, take credit for this thing. It's just the same as me. Who's going to prove anything,
mm-hmm.
you know? Nobody can say, well, I know who does it, or, you know.
Paul Mayer's Children's Television Archive.